from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Author and historian Yuval Noah Harari first gained international prominence with his 2011 bestseller, Sapiens, A Brief History of Mankind. For his new book, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, he has turned his attention to the present day. The biggest threat humanity now faces, Harari says, may be the convergence of biotechnology and artificial intelligence.
We are now hackable animals. For the first time in history, we should realize that we can be hacked.
Coming up on Forum, Harari joins us to talk about his new book and why he retains optimism in the face of vexing global problems. It's all coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Author Yuval Noah Harari rose to international prominence with his global bestsellers, Sapiens and Homo Deus. His new book is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and it's an urgent plea for humans to address our most pressing problems. Chief among them, he writes, may be the convergence of biotechnology and artificial intelligence. Despite their promise, these technological revolutions threaten to disrupt economies, governments, and even our own minds. Yuval Harari has a PhD in history from Oxford, and he lectures at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. And he joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and welcome.
Hello, it's good to be here.
Good to have you here, and pleased to say that I was not a reader of yours until fairly recently. I had friends much smarter than I who were urging me to read you, and indeed I did, and I find that my mind has been working overtime since having that pleasure. You're a very clear writer, and this book was written originally in English.
Yes. I try to be clear, I think, as somebody who speaks to the general public and not to five other professors. If you don't speak clearly, you're not doing your job.
Well, you do reach a lay audience with this and have, and I think of you as one of the most prominent intellectual voices that we've had in quite some time. And I was thinking actually of Susan Sontag, who won the Jerusalem Prize the last time I interviewed her, also a major prominent intellectual, who said fascism and capitalism are no more. They both collapsed. You're sort of saying the same thing, but you're adding the possibility of liberal democracy to that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not no secret that liberal democracy is now in crisis. In the 20th century, we had three big stories trying to explain everything, the past, the future, the present. We had the communist, the fascist, and the liberal story. During the 20th century, first the fascist, then the communist stories collapse. And we were left with just one story, which was very convenient, because if you have just one story, everything seems absolutely obvious and clear where we are going and so forth. And then suddenly, this one story also seems to be collapsing, and it's the most frightening thing in the world to shift from the absolute certainty of having one story to the utter bewilderment of having no story at all. And nobody is coming with an alternative story.
We need a new story, or stories, as it were. Huh?
Yes, humans are storytelling animals. We understand the world through stories, not through facts or statistics. You know, this is a very common mistake that scientists often make, that they think people understand things through facts. And if you just throw enough facts at people, it will change their minds. And it doesn't work, because Homo sapiens, at least 99% of us, think in stories.
Well, in fact, we have in the United States now a presidential administration that is not throwing many facts. In fact, it's throwing a lot of what they call fake news, but also throwing a lot of prevarication at us. And yet that's being assumed. We'll get into this perhaps later on in the interview. I know you've written about Trump, and I want to hear your thoughts on that. Mm-hmm. But I'm also interested in talking with you about democracy as an ideal. And you say it's just really a blip. I mean, as a historian, you say it's a blip. We've had many more oligarchies. Many more monarchies and mm-hmm. certainly autocracies and that sort of thing. So here we have, I think, what you've described as a whole new set of rules as well as stories, because info technology and biotechnology have merged in ways that are unprecedented and are merging and moving us forward in unprecedented ways. And so politics has come down to maybe data.
Politics now is becoming more and more the struggle to control the flow of data, because data is now the most important resource in the world. In ancient times, the most important resource was land, so naturally enough, politics was a struggle to control land. And then machines, in the last two centuries, since the Industrial Revolution, machines replaced land as the most important resource, so politics became a struggle to control the machines. And now data is replacing machines as the most important resource, so politics becomes a struggle to control the flow of data. Now, it doesn't mean that land and machines have completely lost all their importance. They are still important, but now those who control the data are also likely to control the land and the machines.
Can I read something to you that you probably may have come across? Bill Gates did a lead review of your book, your new book.
Yeah, when Bill Gates reviews your book, you read the review.
Well, it's not only
a safe bet.
You have some major fans. Barack Obama has expressed a lot of admiration for your work and so forth. But this was the lead review in the Sunday New York Times. And he says, as much as I admire Harari and enjoy 21 Lessons, I didn't agree with everything in the book. I was glad to see the chapter on inequality, but I'm skeptical about his prediction that in the 21st century, data will eclipse both land and machinery as the most important asset separating rich people from everyone else. Land will always be hugely important, especially as the global population nears 10 billion. Meanwhile, data on key human endeavors, how to grow food or produce energy, for example, will become even more widely available. Simply having information won't offer a competitive edge. Knowing what to do with it will.
Well, I certainly welcome the disagreement. I don't expect everybody to agree with what I write. It will be very boring if everybody just agreed. I think it's important to agree on the questions. What are the most important questions to address? And then we can have a debate on it. Specifically regarding this skepticism about data, it's a bit funny, I think, coming from somebody like Bill Gates. If you think about who are the richest people in the world, so a couple of centuries ago, the richest people would be the landowners, and they make their money from raising wheat and sheep and growing sugar with lots of slaves and things like that. Now, if you look today, so people like Bill Gates, he didn't make his money from owning land and growing wheat. He made it largely from data processing. And this is true of more and more of the rich people of the world. And similarly, when you look at political struggles, so yes, you still struggle to control land in the end, but who gets to win the struggle is more and more a question of who controls the data. I know this, for example, you know, I come from Israel, so we have one of the largest laboratories in the world for surveillance data, which is called the Occupied Territories. And to understand how Israel so efficiently controls millions of very resentful people under its rule, what you need to understand is data, not land.
Well, in fact, you've written about Israel's surveillance over the Palestinians, but they do control they control the sky and they control the airwaves and cyberspace, so it makes it a lot easier to have that control.
Yeah, basically today, whenever a Palestinian picks up a phone or meets somebody or travels, he or she are likely to be monitored, to be surveyed. It's almost impossible to organize any kind of resistance. If you try to get 10 people together, you're being surveyed.
So democracy and dictatorships, if they're in this kind of battle together or this conflict that you've just been described, it comes down to data processing systems and to a great degree in terms of who's going to be the victor?
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at the 20th century, and we tend to think about the conflict between the free world and the Soviet bloc in terms of an ethical conflict, which is true. But underlying the ethical conflict, there was also a conflict in data processing. Democracy and dictatorship, you can say, are two different methods for processing information and making decisions. Democracy works by distributing the information and the power to make decisions between many institutions and individuals. Dictatorship, on the other hand, concentrates all the information and power in one place. Now, given the technological realities of the late 20th century, it was simply inefficient to try and concentrate all the information and power in one place, like Moscow, because nobody could process all that information fast enough and make the right decisions. And this is a major reason why the United States defeated the Soviet Union in the Cold War. But there is no law of nature that distributed systems are always more efficient than centralized systems. And at present, the rise of artificial intelligence and machine learning might swing the pendulum in the opposite direction, making centralized systems of data processing more efficient than distributed systems. Now, some people say that blockchain might be the counterforce to balance these centralizing tendencies of AI and machine learning and big data algorithms. We will wait and see. But we do need to take into account the fact that there is no law of nature that says that democracies or distributed systems are always more efficient. And what happens if we enter an era in which dictatorship is just more efficient?
We're talking with Yuval Noah Harari, if you've just joined us, lecturer at Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His new book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. Other books include Homo Deus and Sapiens. And this is kind of a trilogy. You've gone from the past to the future to the here and now.
Yeah.
And let's talk a little bit more about the effects of what you've described, I mean, technologically particularly, because machines are really competing with manual skills, you write, and now we're moving into a cognitive realm. And you also say that maybe look at chess as the canary in the coal mine and what's happened with chess. And this is often used as an example because machines are beating humans in chess. But how does that play out in your mind?
Well, at first we had machines beating humans in chess, but then we actually saw a flourishing of chess centered around the combination or the cooperation of humans and machines or humans and computers. And actually, chess really saw amazing developments in the last 20 years since Deep Blue defeated Gary Kasparov. But then gradually, the machines became so good that the human component in the AI-human cooperation became less and less important. So if this is kind of the model for the future, then the first stage, as AI becomes better, the first stage is that we will see teams of humans and computers or humans and AI algorithms cooperating in things like banking and policing and trading and teaching in many, many different fields, which will be a big revolution and which will demand a lot of retraining and rebuilding entire systems. But then eventually, the human component might become less and less important in this cooperation until you reach a point when the humans can contribute almost nothing.
And the masses in many ways become more and more irrelevant in this picture.
Yes, I mean, the big fear, nobody knows for sure, but the big fear is that just as the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century created the urban working class, the automation revolution of the 21st century will create the unworking class or the useless class, people who are economically worthless and therefore politically powerless. And this is not just because of the sheer lack of jobs. It is very likely that as old jobs disappear, new jobs will appear. The big problem might be how to retrain people to fill the new jobs.
And especially since they're living longer, too.
Yeah, and people live longer, and you have, and it's not just, you know, it's not just a one-time event. You have a big automation revolution in 2025, lots of jobs disappear, many new jobs appear, you retrain the workforce, and there you go. We are over it. There is a new equilibrium. It won't be like that because AI is not even near its full potential. So yes, we will have huge changes in 2025, but then even bigger changes in 2035, even bigger changes in 2045 and so forth. So you will have basically to reinvent yourself maybe 5, 6, 7 times during your life, and not just to learn new skills, but really to somehow reinvent your personality. If you're a truck driver, and you've been driving a truck for 20 years, and then you lose your job because now they have these self-driving vehicles. But there is a new job, I don't know, teaching yoga. So, okay, you need to learn a set of new skills, but you really need to change your personality. The personality of most yoga teachers is somewhat different from the personality of most truck drivers. So, okay, you make this big effort and the government supports you and you have 1 year of generous unemployment benefits and all these retraining facilities. And after 1 year, you're a happy and certified yoga teacher. 10 years pass, and there is no longer any need of human yoga teachers, because within those 10 years, with amazing biometric sensors, you now have an AI that can monitor what every muscle in your body is doing as you try to get into some yoga posture. And it can give you the kind of guidance that no human can even approach. So after 10 years, you're out of job again. And then you need to reinvent yourself yet again, let's say as a designer of virtual reality games. Again, a different personality, a different set of skills. And who guarantees that within 10 years, this too will be taken over by some machine, by some computer?
In fact, this is the futurist in you. I mean, you're foreseeing the possibility of machines making decisions for us, not only in terms of work but and career, but in terms of relationships. We become more and more irrelevant in that way as well.
Yeah, the biggest struggle in the 21st century might be against irrelevance. In the 20th century, and actually for most of history, the big struggle, the big political and social struggle of most people was against exploitation. There are these elites that are trying to exploit me, and I need to protect myself from exploitation. But in the 21st century, the big story might be irrelevance. I'm trying to protect myself not from exploitation, but from irrelevance. There is these elites that they don't exploit me. They just don't need me. And this is in many ways far more frightening than being exploited, and it's also much more difficult to struggle against irrelevance than against exploitation. When you're exploited, at least they need you. If you go back a century and, you know, you have all these peasants and workers being exploited, if they go on strike or if they stage a revolution, they can't shoot everybody because then nobody will be there to work in the factories. They need them. But if you're irrelevant, that's a different story.
Well, it's a different story. And like you said, we need a new story in the face of all this. But we're also looking at the kind of technology that could be, I mean, and this was clear when television came into, was inaugurated, when computers came in. In fact, we didn't even see the dangers with computers. You're foreseeing a lot of the dangers and things that we can get blindsided by we haven't even seen yet. But the reality is that we're coming against some extraordinary forces here. You make a kind of triad of the nuclear threat on the one hand, and the threat of climate change on the other hand, and then this biotechnology and intertechnology, which is also, especially with AI, a major threat to us, much more than perhaps we can see. But you're visualizing it in ways that get down to human beings being controlled to a much greater extent, and job losses taking place and identity having to be reformed, new stories having to be reformed. Where's the light? Where's the hope in this? Because this can be very dystopian.
Well, first of all, this is not a prophecy. These are just possibilities that we need to take into consideration and we need to be careful about. If it was a certainty that this is the future, there is no point telling people, because what can you do?
But we've messed up with machines all along. I mean, when I think about television, a computer was a great tool, still is a great tool, but it's been weaponized. In our last election.
Yes, but you know, everything can be weaponized. A knife can be weaponized, but you can also use it to cut salad or to save somebody's life if you're a doctor, a surgeon. It doesn't mean that we should abolish all knives, no.
No, I'm not suggesting abolition. I'm just saying, how do we get on the better side of this? You said, I think we can create our paradise or our hell, right?
Yes. I mean, first of all, we need to realize nothing is inevitable. We have still some influence and choice over the direction. We have managed to overcome very big challenges in the past. If you go back 50, 60 years, so you had all these people expecting nuclear holocaust almost any day. Many people were certain that the Cold War will only end with a nuclear war, which will destroy human civilization. And it didn't happen. Actually, humankind managed to rise to this challenge and usher in the most peaceful era.
Mutual assured destruction helped.
You know, nuclear weapons have this wonderful ability to focus people's minds. And when people focus their minds on a huge challenge, they can often come up with good decisions and good solutions. And we can do it again. We just need to be very aware of the challenges and of the dangers. And if you think about, let's take surveillance and AI, which is one of the dangers, not the only ones, but maybe the one that gets the most attention now. And you can use the technology in many ways, and even in opposite ways. Until now, most of the amazing surveillance abilities of artificial intelligence and big data algorithms have been used to survey individuals in the service of corporations and governments. But in principle, you can use the technology in the reverse way. You can use the same technology to survey the behavior of corporations and governments in the service of individuals. You can survey, for example, government officials to make sure they are not corrupt. So, you know, you have all these governments being very happy about, yes, we need to survey what you do and what you say and what you buy in order to organize society and to preserve the law and so forth. So you tell them, okay, why not survey you and follow your emails and bank accounts and everything you do? I want to follow what this member of Congress is doing every day to make sure there is no corruption there. I could never have done it before because I didn't have the tools, but now we have the tools.
It reminds me of what's going on in the White House. There's surveillance now after the New York Times op-ed of probably everybody who's working there. But I'm wondering, what's your take on Trump? I mean, you've tried to explain him in a number of instances, but you see it to some extent, don't you, in this battle between democracy and autocracy?
Well, I don't really understand American politics deeply. I hardly even understand what's the big difference between Democrats and Republicans. I mean, coming from a place like Israel, most of the political differences in America strike me as quite small. But I would say that the Trump, or certainly most of his supporters, they are not anti-democratic. They see themselves as very democratic, as expressing the will of the people and so forth. The main thing you can say about what's happening now, I don't know about the future, is that Trump and his administration gave up the global ideal of liberal democracy. They no longer think that America has a mission to spread democracy or to even care about democracy in the rest of the world, which is a very big difference. You know, 10 years ago, Americans were still trying to force people on the other side of the world to become more democratic with guns and bombings, which wasn't a very good idea. I'm not saying if it's good or bad, just what is happening. What is happening is that America is renouncing its kind of global mission. And nobody really has.
This is going to get us into a lot of areas, but I want to give listeners an opportunity also to join the conversation.
Oh, yeah, sure.
If Bill Gates would disagree with you, then this little peasant in front of the microphone here, Michael Krasny, can. And I want to get into some of those areas as well. But let me give listeners a number to join us at. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786. You can join us with our guest, Yuri Noah Harari. Again, the number to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Many ways you could be part of this conversation and join the program. And again, our guest is the author of a new book called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. His other books include Homo Deus and Sapiens. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Yuval Noah Harari. He's a lecturer at Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and his new book is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And I just want to touch upon something before we go to our callers and emailers. And by the way, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786 or by email, forum@kqed.org. I wanted you write about tribalism as being really central to a lot of the forces that are very much with us now. And I think kind of downplay nationalism. I think nationalism it probably is much more important than you do. So I'd like you to make that case. And I say that with all due respect for the fact that you're a historian. And as you point out, World War I was a disaster because of nationalism. But we've changed. We've morphed. We've gone into different mutations. Nevertheless, I think Trump has a lot to do with nationalism. I think Brexit has a lot to do with nationalism. So the idea of nationalism being eclipsed by tribalism?
No, not so much eclipsed. I would say two important things to remember about nationalism is that it's much less powerful than it used to be, and it's not natural to human beings. So first, the claim that it's less powerful than before. A century ago, Europeans were killing each other by the million over national conflicts. When you look at Brexit, the most amazing thing to me as a historian, when I look at Brexit, is that just one person lost her life. You know, a century ago, a question like Brexit, should Britain be completely independent or part of a European conglomerate, you could decide that only through a major war, with hundreds of thousands of people being killed. Now people just vote about it, and if your side loses, you just go and have a pint and you know, complain to your friends at the pub.
Isn't this a little bit with Steven Pinker's notion that violence itself has decreased enormously?
Yeah, violence
globally?
Has decreased dramatically, which is a wonderful thing. Not in all parts of the world. Again, I come from the Middle East. I know perfectly well that there are still parts of the world which are extremely violent, but compared to any previous time in history, we are living still in the most peaceful era ever. The other main thing to remember about nationalism is that, contrary to what many people think and say, it's not natural at all to Homo sapiens. We are social animals. We have it in our genes to be loyal to a group, that's for sure, but evolution adapted us to be loyal to a very small group of people we really know. For hundreds of thousands of years, we were loyal to a small group of friends and family members, and we intimately knew each and every one of them. These were groups of a couple of dozen people, maybe 100 or 200. Now, nationalism, the chief characteristic of nationalism is that you are loyal to millions of complete strangers. You know nothing about them on the personal level. You never met them. You will never meet them. And nevertheless, you feel very strongly, very strong loyalty to them. And this is really a miracle, a cultural miracle, that you can make apes like us be so loyal to being willing to sacrifice your life, or at least to pay taxes, to support millions of complete strangers you've never met. And this has happened only in the last few thousand years, which is yesterday morning in evolutionary terms. And if we can get these apes to be loyal, like in the United States, you are loyal to 300 million people, strangers you have never met, this is really a miracle. To go from there to being loyal to 8 billion people you have never met, this is quite a short distance. So I think nationalism is much, much closer to globalism, to being loyal to the whole of humankind, than it is to ancient tribalism.
Humankind, which nevertheless, in Darwinian terms, are apes.
Oh, we are still apes, that's for sure.
Let me bring our callers in here. Let's go first to Martin. Martin, join us. You're on the air.
Hey, this is a great topic. Speaking to irrelevancy of the human species, you know, a lot of people already at retirement age or even technology-wise, they feel irrelevant. So what do you see or anticipate humans doing when we're irrelevant? Are we all focused on video games and just some score on a leaderboard somewhere? Or, you know, what are we going to be doing?
That's a very good question. We just don't know. We don't understand the human mind well enough. And we don't have models for such a society. You have the dystopian vision. The most extreme dystopian vision is that people are just being completely left behind and nobody takes care of them, and most of them just go extinct. A less dystopian vision is that everybody or most people just play virtual reality games all day. When you have nothing to do, drugs and computer games will provide the answer for most people. You have far more utopian visions of people suddenly having the time and the ability to pursue their deepest dreams and realize their full human potential, with things ranging from meditation and spiritual quests to art and sports and so forth. What will actually happen? Nobody knows. Maybe different parts of humanity have very different futures. In some parts of the planet or in some neighborhoods, you will have the utopian vision of exploring and developing the human potential to its fullest. And in other parts of the globe or of the city, you will have the worst case scenarios. We just don't know.
And I thank the caller. You do emphasize in your work, though, the necessity for cooperation, global cooperation, particularly with the three things that you have said could be doom for this planet, and the mm-hmm. necessity of, you got a lot of C's here, critical thinking, communication, collaboration, and creativity, and cooperation being perhaps the most important in some ways. Mm-hmm. But I'm getting already some feedback from listeners. Gabriel, for example, says, to me, it seems global warming will wash away data, land, and machines entirely. In other words, I see Mr. Harari as an optimist.
In a way, you can say yes, but I'm afraid that global warming will have different impact on different parts of the world and different parts of society. It will not stop the development of new technologies in fields like AI and biotechnology. It will only accelerate them. One scenario is that global warming will fulfill the same function in the 21st century that the two world wars fulfilled in the 20th century. It will accelerate dramatically technological development, because all kinds of dangerous, high gain, high risk technologies that you wouldn't like to pursue in normal peacetime conditions, when things get very difficult, then you throw caution to the wind. And this happened, for example, in the Second World War with projects like the Manhattan Project. And this is likely to happen again in case of catastrophic climate change. Then governments and people will support all kinds of radical technological experiments.
Technology is already advancing very rapidly. In fact, in our next hour, we're going to talk to mayors from four cities, including Cape Town and Edmonton, who are working with new technologies and working with innovation, because we have the big climate summit going on right now as we speak. We also have a lot of callers who want to talk with us. Let's go next to Victor. Victor, join us. You're on the air.
Hi. So I work as a machine learning scientist at a company here in the Bay Area, and it's just interesting to hear how you guys are talking about automation of decision processes, because we started with 16 folks who are very advanced, had bachelor's degrees or master's degrees in some cases, doing some very tricky technical work. And essentially I've come in with machine learning algorithms, and I've been able to automate essentially 80% of what they do. And so in the future, we're probably going to just fully automate the whole thing. And so now we're down to about four people on that team. And it's just interesting to see. And I was just wondering what you guys thought of universal basic income as a way to kind of help solve this problem.
Let me defer to our guest on this, and thank you for the question.
I think that the two big problems with universal basic income is what is universal and what is basic. Most people, when they speak of universal basic income, they actually mean national basic income. They think in terms of, okay, let's raise taxes on the big high-tech corporations in Silicon Valley in order to give basic income to unemployed coal miners in Pennsylvania and unemployed taxi drivers in New York. But the really big problem will not be in Pennsylvania and New York. The really, really big problems will be in places like Honduras and Mexico and Bangladesh and Indonesia, when tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people might lose their jobs in industries like textile. And do we really think that any American government that can stay in office and win elections is going to raise taxes on American corporations in California and use that to pay unemployment benefits to people in Honduras? If you think this is likely, you just as well think that Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny will combine forces to solve the problem. So this is the problem of universal in universal basic income. And the second issue is, what is basic? Who defines when in that kind of world? For most people, they are not going to get anything beyond the basics because they don't work. So how can they get anything more? And then the question is, who defines what is basic? What is basic in terms of healthcare? So in 50 years, I guess everybody will have better healthcare, or almost everybody, than today. But people never compare themselves to their ancestors. They compare themselves to their neighbors. Even today, most Americans get far better healthcare than in the 18th century. But nobody cares about that. You compare yourself to your neighbors. So in 2050, if the rich people get, say, infinite life extensions, while you're stuck with just basic healthcare, you're going to be very, very unhappy about that. So the big question about basic income is what or who defines what is basic?
When you talk about Honduras and countries like that, it also brings to mind the fact that we're facing globally a refugee crisis unlike anything we've probably ever seen since the Second World War. And mm-hmm. A lot of what's coming north here from places like Honduras is coming here for the opportunities, the jobs, and so forth, which, as you say, are constricting. I wonder what your thoughts are. I mean, you raise a lot of the right questions, and you do have some answers here on a personal level, like meditation and mindfulness, and mm-hmm. that plays very well to this audience in the West Coast, by the way. But I'm just wondering what you have to say about this, the sustainability of the planet, and with respect to all of these people who are trying. Hungary today, I was happening to listen to the BBC, is being essentially chastised by the EU and maybe even have something levied against them mm-hmm. because they've been so adamantly against taking in refugees.
Yeah.
And this has been certainly the Trump administration, too.
Yeah, we need to realize that no country today is really independent anymore. All this idea of independent countries, it's no longer viable, because when it comes to the three big challenges humankind faces, nuclear war, climate change, and technological disruption, there is no such thing as independent countries. You are not independent. If you think about, take an extreme case like Kiribati, which is a small island nation in the Pacific. Kiribati can have the best environmental policies in the whole world. They can reduce their greenhouse gas emissions to zero, and they will still be swallowed by the Pacific Ocean if other countries don't adopt better environmental policies. So Kiribati is not ecologically independent. And the same is true of Bangladesh, and the same is even true of China.
None of us are ecologically independent.
Exactly. And the same goes, of course, for nuclear development, but also for technological development. Again, if you take something like, I don't know, let's leave AI aside and think for a moment about bioengineering. Let's say that you're very concerned, or we are very concerned, about doing genetic engineering on human beings, and we decide to ban genetic engineering of human babies. What will that help unless you get all the countries to adopt the same regulations? Because if the Chinese or the Russians are doing it, then nobody would like to stay behind. And the same way is development of things like killer robots or autonomous weapon systems. So if we want and we need to regulate dangerous technologies, the regulation can only be effective on a global level. So any politician who thinks, or any voter who thinks in strictly national terms, only my country is important, my country first, I would ask this politician, how can your country by itself, without any global cooperation, stop climate change or regulate artificial intelligence?
And we go to another caller, and that's you, Steve. You're on the air with us. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing today? So I was thinking to myself, you know, instead of picking our way of being irrelevant because of AI, how about working side by side with AI and dealing with exploration? You know, we all have in our DNA as explorers, and just like the Europeans back in the 1800s, well, long ago, once they had the technology to have ships, to build ships, they explored other lands. So now we have the technology to, you know, work with AI to explore the universe around us.
Steve, I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, this is something people like Elon Musk have been long advocating. Mm-hmm. What about space exploration in terms of the future as you see it, Yuval Harari?
Well, I think space exploration, humans have very little possibility there. In terms of internal exploration, that's a different matter.
No, but he's talking about AI.
Exploration of outer space.
Using AI.
Yeah, I mean, humans are just not adapted, and all organisms for 4 billion years have been adapted to living on this particular planet with this particular gravity and cosmic radiation and so forth and so on. And we are, as organic beings, we are just not adapted to space exploration or space colonization. I think that we will see space exploration and space colonization, but not by organic beings, not by Homo sapiens. We are likely to create all kinds of robots and algorithms that will explore and colonize the space, but not us.
I'm sorry, I just was going to elicit a comment here. The only dimension I feel is underdeveloped in Harari's work is deeper appreciation for the human brain. For example, could the rise of political deterioration best be understood in the context of an aging population exhibiting the characteristics of aging brains in aggregate?
I'm not an expert on that. I would be quite skeptical of this interpretation. But yes, I would agree completely that our understanding of the human brain, and much more so our understanding of the human mind, is very, very rudimentary and limited. We know almost nothing about the human mind and its full capacities. Most jobs that exist today utilize just a tiny, tiny percentage of the human capacity. If you think about jobs ranging from being a cashier in a supermarket to being a banker, it utilizes just a tiny part of the spectrum of what the human mind can do. So there is a lot of room for development and exploration.
Including hacking the brain, as you've pointed out in your work.
One avenue is hacking the brain, but there are different avenues. In terms of jobs and economics, the big problem with this kind of exploration and development is really psychological. That it demands the kind of mental flexibility. And here age also comes into the picture.
That's why you advocate, for example, learning about emotional intelligence to a greater degree. Yeah.
That we don't know what the job market or the world would look like in 2050. We do know it will be very different from today and very hectic. So the best bets, if you're thinking about education, especially of young people today, the best bet is to develop their emotional intelligence and mental flexibility, because they are definitely going to need that in order to repeatedly reinvent themselves. And I think there is a lot of scope for human exploration and reinvention. The question is, do we have the psychological skills and really the mental balance to do that? Especially beyond a certain age, it becomes more and more difficult to reinvent yourself. So even in the practical terms of the job market, there might be a lot of new jobs out there, but a lot of people might not have the psychological flexibility to reinvent themselves repeatedly in order to fill these jobs.
We're talking with Yuval Noah Harari. He's here in studio with us. His new book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And Hillary writes, your guest paints a frightening picture of the future. I wonder if he believes there is a possibility that our world will find value in its citizens beyond their economic potential, countering the evolution into irrelevance.
I hope so. History is not very optimistic in this regard. For most of history, people were valued according to their economic contribution and even military contribution to the army, to the state. We could envision models of societies in which people are valued for different purposes, for different reasons. But we need to work very hard in order to develop these models both on a theoretical level and also on a practical level. So there are some very good suggestions out there. For instance, a very important contribution coming from feminist thinking is that, you know, there are a lot of jobs that are just not recognized as jobs, and they are some of the most important jobs in the world, and they are not going to disappear anytime soon, such as raising children. And so maybe we just need to start valuing more, also in economic terms, these kinds of hidden jobs that have been there all along, but for all kinds of political and cultural reasons, have so far not been even considered as jobs.
Here's another listener who wants you to be oracular for us. Is your guest for or against the widespread integration of AI in our society? Will the transition be guided by economics only, or will moral and ethical constraints have a say?
I don't think you can stop the rise and spread of AI. I do think you can influence the direction it is taking. And I certainly think that there is, we need to take ethical considerations into account. I would say that today, any college or university that trains people in computer science and doesn't force them to take at least a few points in computer ethics or the ethics of coding or the ethics of writing algorithms, this is extremely irresponsible. I mean, some of the most important ethical questions today in the world involve writing algorithms. If you are there, our listeners, writing algorithms, and you have no education, no experience in the ethics of algorithms, of writing algorithms, this is a hugely irresponsible.
Listening to Forum, and we're talking with Yuval Noah Harari. His new book is called 21 Lessons for the 21st Century, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, we urge you to go to kqed.org. And we're going to go to more callers in just a moment, but we're also going to split from you because we're going to hear some importuning. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more callers. Let me go next to Eamon. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, I want to say I tremendously enjoyed Mr. Harari's two books. So thank you so much for those two wonderful books. And I had a general question regarding whether we're overly optimistic about technology. We're already running into the limits of technologies for things like the number of transistors, the efficiency of the internal combustion engine. So is it likely that this technological progress will come to a halt and run against the physical limits of nature?
I don't think we'll see something like that anytime soon. For the last 500 years, there has just been a constant acceleration. And every time we think that we are bumping against some natural wall, we have some scientific breakthrough that leads us in completely unexpected directions. I mean, to take the example of energy sources. So, you know, two centuries ago, nobody knew anything about the potential uses of oil or of uranium as sources of energy. And the amazing thing is, if you look at the last 200 years, humanity has been using more and more energy, and all the time, the amount of energy at our disposal has been growing instead of shrinking. Why? Because we constantly discover new sources of energy and new ways to utilize existing energy. I don't think that we are anywhere near exhausting the energy resources. And similarly, I don't think we are anywhere near the final technological improvement.
When people sort of say, shouldn't we stop all this technology or put a halt to it and everything, what you keep coming back to is the fact that the metaphor in my mind is it's a Pandora's box, and once it's, or the genie out of the bottle, once mm-hmm. It's out there.
Yeah, I mean, you can influence the direction it's taking. That's for sure. There is nothing inevitable about any kind of technology, but the idea that we can just stop it. No more development in AI. No more development in biotechnology. Maybe in one country. You can do it with some dictatorial regime, but not in the entire world. And you have this arms race logic that if we don't want to do it, but the other side is doing it, so we also have to do it because we can't be left behind. There are certain directions which we should go more slowly, or maybe we should not go in that direction at all. But to accomplish this kind of thing, you need a global agreement. You need global cooperation. If you just do it on a national level, it won't work.
You need more than global cooperation. You also need monitoring, and you need trust, and you need to make sure that things are going the
right
way.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot that you can achieve a very high degree of trust between people. If you think about, again, something like killer robots, and it's a bad idea to have killer robots, let's ban them. So if you think, let's say, about France and Germany, these two countries have a terrible history over the last few centuries between them. But today, if the Germans come to the French and tell them, trust us, we don't have any secret laboratory working on killer robots in order to conquer France, I think the French will believe the Germans. They will trust them, and they have good reason to trust them. And if France and Germany have managed to achieve this level of trust between them, I don't think it's impossible to reach the same level of trust between, say, the Chinese and the Americans. It's not going to happen anytime soon, and given the current policies of the White House, I don't think that we are in the right direction, but I don't think it's an impossibility either.
Let me bring another caller aboard here. James, that's you. Thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I have an observation that I'd like your reaction to, and that is that perhaps I'm wondering if what we're talking about fundamentally that's occurring is a challenge to a couple of ideas that came out of the European Enlightenment as well as many other cultures. The first that we talk about a lot is the idea that human beings are fundamentally equal on some important levels. The second, which I don't think we're talking about, is the idea that human beings are ends in themselves and not simply means. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what your guest thought about that.
Yeah, Yuval Harari.
Both ideas are being challenged. And in the end, they are being challenged, I think, most forcefully from science, from the laboratories. Yes, they are challenged by all kinds of autocrats and all kinds of extreme ideological movements across the world. But the really big challenge is coming from the laboratories and coming from this new ability to hack human beings. And you have all these metaphysical notions from the 18th century about what a human being is, which were the basis for our humanist society. And these notions are just not scientifically tenable in the 21st century.
We're going to have to leave it there. It's been a delight to have you on. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yuri Harari's new book is 21 Lessons for the 21st Century. And we have another hour ahead. We're going to meet four mayors who are doing, well, in each of their cases, a lot to ameliorate the problems related to climate change. The big summit is going on as we speak. Stay tuned for that. It's up ahead. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.